Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Dave Hoekstra with Dan Wong producing the show. Last Saturday night, we were parked outside of Fitzgerald's in our little Bluebird Ford Transit van. How'd you like that, Dan? Was that fun?
Yeah, it was the first time I saw it after hearing about it so much. It was pretty fun.
So, we have a little office in there. We have a little desk. And what else do we have? We have a chair. We had an air conditioner that really didn't work, but that was okay because the interview sounded okay.
It wouldn't have worked anyway with us running the recorder.
And we brought in some of our favorite Saturday night musicians from the American Music Festival into the van. And we had Billy Prine, our friend Billy Prine, who's been on the show. We had John D. Graham, the legendary Texas singer-songwriter. We're going to air those on podcasts this week, right?
Yeah, we'll have those up at some point on WGNradio.com.
And we're going to play now. This was just a really fascinating interview, and his songs were just great. It's Curtis McMurtry, and he's the grandson of the author, Larry McMurtry, and he is the son of the singer-songwriter, James McMurtry, who was also at the festival last weekend. And I found it a really, really fascinating interview. You know, it sounded good, didn't it?
Yeah, sounded good. And there was a real, you know, you mentioned the American Music Festival at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. It had a real summer festival feel. It was just a great atmosphere. We were getting musicians, you know, right after they stepped off the stage, and it was just a real cool atmosphere.
It was neat. And actually, I talked to a couple people. They said they were kind of hanging. We had the door closed, but they were hanging outside, and they heard Curtis sing and stuff, you know. And I thought it was interesting, you know, the year and a half or so we've been doing this show. That was only the second or third interview I've done in the van, but the rapport was really interesting with the guests. I was kind of closer to them in the chair, and we found that in Portland, too. We're going to do a segment later in the month. We talked to some book people in Portland, and it's just, I think the atmosphere in that van's kind of good for interviews.
Yeah, although it is kind of close quarters in there, because you guys were right, like, in front of each other, and I was running the tape recorder sitting on the bed, like, behind.
Yeah,
so it's cramped, but it was fun.
The best part about it is I locked the door, so when I ask a hard question, no one can leave. But anyway, here's really enjoy Curtis McMurtry. You're going to learn some stuff from him from last Saturday at Fitzgerald's.
Tell us a little about yourself. I mean, in your own words, were you born in Austin, singer-songwriter?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Austin, and then I went to New York for college, and I lived in Nashville for about a year. And then I moved back to Austin because I missed breakfast tacos.
Did you? And how old are you? 20. I've got 25.
25, yeah.
25 years old. Mm-hmm. So what was it like growing up? I mean, what type of music did you listen to? What type of books did you read? What was it like growing up in your family?
Well, I got a lot of, for a while, I got most of my music taste from my father. That was Steve Earle, John Hyatt, Johnny Cash. All the Johns, really. John Hartford, John Prine. And that was what I was really into until I got out of middle school. And then I started listening more to what my mom was into, which was West African stuff and a lot of Latin music and a lot of jazz. So, and then when I went to college, I listened to a lot of classical music. So, and that's what I ended up studying for the most part, was music and composition and ethnomusicology. So, well, I think I started with Steve Earle and John Hartford. That kind of got pushed to the background after a while.
And tell the listeners who your father is.
My father is named James McMurtry.
Yeah. Was music in I know you probably get these questions a lot. Was music in an inevitable course for you, or did he stay out of your way? Did he tell you? I mean, what was his influence on you?
Well, I usually tell people this, that I have a lot of friends who are engineers, and their parents are also engineers, and it's not so much that their parents ever told them they should be engineers, that's just the life that was familiar to them. So they ended up on that path, not necessarily because they felt they had to, not because there was a shadow they had to get out of, but because it made sense to them as a lifestyle. And I feel music has been the same for me, and songwriting has been the same for me, where I didn't have a great idea how to go and work in an office at a tech startup like many of my friends have ended up doing, but driving around the country, getting to the gig on time, writing a song that holds together makes perfect sense.
Were there musicians around the house? Did people come over?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Austin music community is fairly well, depending on which music community, I won't pretend there's only one in town, which is the great part about Austin is there's lots of different cliques you can sort of drift between. But you'll have John D on later. John D's family to me.
Yeah. How has he helped you out?
Example, mostly, where John D commits maybe more than anyone else to what he does. He's a true artist.
You went to Nashville.
I did.
For how long?
I lasted about a year.
Okay, now, what, you say you lasted a year, what was the difference, what did you see the difference between Nashville and Austin?
There's a lot more money in music in Nashville, and it's a motivating factor in a way that it isn't in Austin, because there simply isn't the infrastructure there. I'm not certain why, but we've never had the publishing houses or the licensing or the management services there. So what I usually tell people is that my very favorite songwriters are in Austin, but the average songwriter in Nashville is light years ahead of the average Austin songwriter in terms of attention to form, attention to detail. I feel that in Austin, for many people, writing a song is a confessional process, and once you've written it, you don't rework it. It means too much to you. You're too sentimental. I don't feel that way about my material at all, and so in some senses I felt much more comfortable in Nashville, where you're a little bit more detached from the work. You're trying to make every verse as strong as the one that came before it. You don't put a bridge just because you think the song needs a bridge. You want the song to be concise.
Is there more collaboration in Nashville? I remember talking to Prine once about he could never get around the idea of like making an appointment to write a song and stuff. More collaboration and more solo?
Absolutely more collaboration in Nashville. Co-writing is how you meet people often. And it's kind of like blind dates a good bit. And the analogy holds together better than I think it should, where if a co-write doesn't go all that well, you maybe don't see that person anymore. If you do in a public place, you maybe avoid eye contact. If you made an ugly baby, it makes you feel weird. Uh-huh. For sure.
Is there a point where you feel comfortable to share it with somebody or bring it out a little bit more, and then who do you show it to? How does that process take a further step?
I mean, if I'd stayed in Nashville longer, maybe I would have become more comfortable with co-writing and wouldn't be so squeamish about it. But the truth was that I did a lot of co-writes while I was there, and I'm proud of very little of what came out of most of them. And I am selfish, and I do have trouble really bringing the lines that I'm working on that I'm proudest of to someone else, because I don't want people touching my toys necessarily. I don't want people touching my stuff. And the few times it worked out, it was very specific, where I felt I knew the other person and I knew their style, and so if I had something that was in their wheelhouse, that's what I would show them, and I wouldn't try and give them something where I thought they would have to reach. I wanted to bring something I knew that they were already adept at. I know a lot of people that have that strategy where they think, all right, if I'm writing with this person, it's going to be one of these four or five types of songs that they already do well. So that's one thing, one strategy, I suppose.
Do you want to play a song right now?
Sure.
You'll be the first person to play a song in this band.
You shining like a lighter in a foxhole, and without delay I put you in my sights. For many years I watched you dancing in my crosshairs, but I couldn't pull the trigger for my life. But then one day I got the stones to take your hand, dear, and I won you with a flower and a smile. All I had to offer was a fireplace and a face you learned to love after a while. Mm-hmm. One day I was called to serve my country, and I went because I'd never been away. And I returned home with a bandage on my forehead and a memory that gets weaker every day. And now you never touch me like you used to, and my injuries don't even start to heal. And I was sure out then and there that I would lose you. Oh, how wretched your beauty makes me feel. I used to think our love was but a trifle. I was surprised it lasted through the month of May. But now I am too old to lift my rifle, and you're still here to watch me waste away. My love, I've lost so many friends since we got married, and I know that you could say the same to me. I believe I was the first to ever catch you. Perhaps I should be the first to set you free. Shining like the sunlight through the window, and the truth had started slowly sinking in. And I knew when I walked out the door this morning, I would never see your pretty face again. So don't go searching for my body in the cattails. Just be happy that I've found a place to rest. By the time you read this letter, I'll be gone, dear. You know I love you, but this is for the best. You know I love you, but this is for the best.
Welcome back to our interview with Curtis McMurtry on WGN Nocturnal Journal. We talked to him last Saturday night at the Fitzgerald's Music Festival in our camper van. And in this segment, he's going to talk about the distillery process of songwriting.
I'll tell you a little bit about my writing style. Yeah. I refer to it as the distillery method, where I write 24 lines every day and assume that most of them will be utter garbage. And every few weeks I will go back through the giant Word document I've been working on since middle school and find the stuff. I'll sort through the garbage, so to speak, and find the stuff that looks like it might be all right. This could maybe go in a song if I worked it a little better. That goes into another Word document. Then I comb through that, find the stuff I think, no, this would be easy to sing in front of people. I wouldn't cringe at all. This would be great. So that gets filtered into the next one. And then when I've got the stuff that I think these are all legitimate pieces of songs, I just try and find the same character talking throughout the what I've filtered it down through. And that's how I sew songs together, per se. And it helps me a lot more than sitting there with a blank page thinking, what am I going to write about? Here are these chords I found that I liked. Let's do this. Blank page, you and me. I have real trouble with that, but if I've filtered down most of the lines that I need, it comes together much quicker for me. So that one came the same way all the songs I write do, where I found the same character talking through it, and that's how it got sewn together.
That's quite a commitment.
I'm more consistent that way. it really bothers me if I've got two-thirds of a good song and I don't spike the landing. Mm-hmm. It's important to me that it comes out consistent if possible.
Now, I mean, growing up around books and stuff, I mean, you must read. Tell me some of your literary influences, and does that bleed into your songwriting, or is that two separate things?
I like to think everything bleeds into my songwriting. I'm sure the TV I watch does. In terms of literature, it's Flannery O'Connor and Faulkner those are the touchstones for me, absolutely. And that's what I reread the most in terms of who's in the canon anyway. And for what I read on a daily basis, for the last few years, it's mostly just been biographies of jazz musicians.
I don't really? Like who?
I just finished one today on Louis Armstrong. Author is Terry Teachout. The book's called Pops. I'm not sure if I have a tidy explanation for why I've gravitated towards that material right now, but I've been reading a lot of them. A lot of Louis Armstrong, a lot of Duke Ellington, a lot of Thelonious Monk. Finished a book recently on Hazel Scott, who is a tremendous pianist who melded jazz and classical long before anyone else. And when part of her shtick for a while was she would swing the classics, she would play Chopin and give it a swing beat. And she was huge. She was bigger than Billie Holiday for a little while. And I blame jazz scholarship for the reason she's not a household name, because it doesn't tend to focus on women who weren't primarily instrumentalists. Uh-huh. If you were a singer, you've got a lot of books about you, but Hazel Scott was, she sang as well, but she was primarily a piano player, and she's been overlooked for some reason. She's better than many that were out there. And her mother was also a musician, played tenor saxophone, had an all-woman jazz orchestra. Doesn't seem to make it into any curriculum in jazz history somehow.
Wow.
But it happened.
Wow.
It happened more often than that, too. A lot of things fall through the cracks.
How'd you find her?
To be honest, Facebook.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's the same. You're seeing a lot of videos of Sister Rosetta Tharpe getting shared right now. The Hazel Scott videos are the same idea. It's a movement. Hey, look. You know, we make a novelty out of the woman blues singer, shredding guitar player, or jazz musician. It wasn't a novelty. It was always there. We just continue to ignore it, even if it wasn't ignored at the time.
Alex Chilton once told me that, not to drop a name, but he liked the Johnny Ray biography, the singer Johnny Ray. I mean, do you, and that he's got kind of a tragic ending, but do you pursue these musical biographies for the musical aspect, or the story, the curve of the story and stuff? I
think it's the musical aspect, really. Yeah. I'm very interested in innovation through rebellion, so I like to know what was everyone playing when Louis Armstrong came up, what made him push against that to transcend it.
That's interesting.
What tradition were you steeped in that you then decided you needed to bust the walls out in all directions? That's something that I gravitate towards again and again for whatever reason.
Now, how can people find your record? Give us a website, information to find you, and then I just also, what are you working on now?
My website is curtismcmurtrymusic.com. I'm on Bandcamp, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, whatever. Album's not too hard to find if you Google my name. Respectable Enemy, Curtis McMurtry. I just recorded a new album about maybe a month ago now. And I'll be mixing it in August and mastering it in August. It should be out late February, early March is the plan right now.
Is that a working title?
The Hornet's Nest.
Oh, okay.
So named for the bloodiest part and what was at the time the bloodiest battle fought on American soil, the Battle of Shiloh. The very center of the fighting was referred to as the Hornet's Nest in that battle.
We're going to take a break here for David Jennings and the news, and we'll be back and wrap it up with Curtis McMurtry, and then we're also going to talk about our night, Dan and Arden's night at the Disco Demolition book release party. So don't go away on WGN.
So Some would say I crossed a line. She put her lips up next to mine, and right then I forgot you were my friend. I did it for myself, you know. I never meant to hurt you so, but I can't say I won't do it again. Oh, brother, don't you get so sore. I never meant to start a war. It's not my fault she loves me more than you. Not a race unless I win. I know where her mouth has been. Believe me when I tell you I don't care. And anyway, she came to me. I never made her do a thing. You're a grown man now. It's time you learn to share. Oh, brother, don't you get so sore. I never meant to start a war. It's not my fault she loves me more than you. I understand you're angry, but I don't want to fight you. You knew I was a snake, so of course I'm gonna bite you. Try between the soil and the sky. No one could ever keep me in a cage. You're not the only one I've wronged. I don't know what side I'm on, but you should know by now that I won't change. Ah, sister, don't you get so sore. I never meant to start a war. It's not my fault he loves me more than you. It is not my fault he loves me more than you. It's not my fault he loves me more than you.
Welcome back with Curtis McMurtry from Austin, Texas. How's the traffic in Austin? That's the last time I was there, it was rough, and it was a long time ago.
It's getting worse.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate enough to not have a 9-to-5 job right now, yeah. So I get to duck the worst of the traffic.
Yeah. So tell us about that track.
That one's called Loves Me More. I wrote it while I was in Nashville. I was thinking maybe that might have some Fred Kohler influence in it now that you brought up the funny.
Yeah. So, when you played Fitzgerald's before?
Yeah, a few times over the last couple of years.
What's your itinerary like the rest of the summer? I doubt if you'll be back this way soon. You were just played here.
Nah, not quite.
Yeah.
I'm going to the East Coast for the rest of this month, for the rest of July. Be playing in Boston, be playing in New York. Be all up and down the East Coast. All the tour dates are on, most of the tour dates are on my website, curtismcmurtrymusic.com. A few of them are kind of secret shows, so be on the lookout for subtle hints about those on my Facebook page. If you like me on Facebook, Curtis McMurtry Music.
I was going to ask John D. this a little bit later, but, I mean, how is it gigging out there? I mean, is it hard? What's the club scene like? Do you do house concerts?
I do a ton of house concerts. Yeah. Those save me. I won't lie. Those can be sometimes the most lucrative show on a tour. And I don't mean to say that, like, there's no money in the clubs, because there's totally money in clubs some nights or small theaters. I've learned always know when the NFL playoffs are. Try not to play on those nights in a city you've never been to.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, little things like that.
We don't have to worry about that in Chicago.
Yeah. But you know, I'm fairly spoiled. I've had if there's 10 people in the room that are listening to things I made, I'm top of the world there, you know? I mean, I want more, sure, but if there's anyone there at all, it feels good.
Well, I imagine a house concert, you get an audience
house
paying attention.
Yeah, for sure. And that's gratifying, because I'm not really going to go up there and play Led Zeppelin for them.
Yeah.
I work on my guitar playing for sure, but I'm not going to shred.
Yeah.
Really, it's going to be, I need them to hear every word and every syllable, so a house concert is very conducive to that.
Last question, what do you travel around in? I'm just asking that because we're in this van, so.
Ride around in a 2006 Toyota Corolla. Ride's great.
Are you good with mechanical stuff?
Mm-hmm. Nope, I just take it into the shop all the time, forever.
We need work on the air.
Yeah, I wish I could help you.
Yeah.
Nope, I'm fairly dainty city boy.
Now, musically, what I really like about the record I heard, Respectful Enemy, and if you can talk about some of your arrangements, what you do with the horns and the strings, and maybe talk about what you learned at Sarah Lawrence College and stuff. And,
sure.
For listeners, I mean, it's easy to say. I mean, I did hear a little bit of that magnetic fields thing and stuff as a lazy point of reference. But, I mean, I think gives you that a distinct hook there. So tell me how that experience in New York influenced what you
did. Yeah, well, I'd played saxophone from when I was 11 through high school. So I already had a taste for wind ensemble, and I loved orchestras. But I didn't have that skill set. I'd never composed anything or through composed anything before college, but that ended up being really what I did there, was studying composition, writing string quartets, writing chamber music for the most part. And that's what gave me the taste. That's what it made the troubadour aesthetic less appealing to me, for yeah. certain, to where I wanted to hear cellos, really. I wanted to hear less guitar, more cello, more muted trumpet, more tenor saxophone. And I'm always really excited about how arrangement can help you push your lyrics through, really, that it can... You run a risk, because the more sounds you introduce into the track, the more distracting they can become, but they can also really... Man, a trumpet growling at the end of a really sinister line you throw out there can drive that home.
Do you do the same thing with, like, some of the female vocals and stuff I hear?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I love vocal harmonies.
Yeah.
You can't get much more expressive than the human voice.
Yeah, yeah. Were you going off with some of these arrangements? Was that, like, a whole new world? I mean, was that... Did you produce... I don't know the credits on the record. Did you produce it yourself, or was there a producer who...
I produced it with Will Sexton.
Oh, okay.
He helped immeasurably. He's got a just genius musical mind, where he would hear things on track I never thought of. But I did go into the record already having the string and horn arrangements and being willing to fight for them, and that was a point of contention for sure. As well as Will and I get along, Will wanted more of that troubadour aesthetic, wanted more of just me and a guitar, and I didn't want that especially. And so there's a sort of a push and pull throughout the album between very lushly arranged tracks and tracks that ended up being much more sparse, and I appreciate it now. I love that contrast, but had it been up to either one of us entirely, it would be a different record for sure.
I think it's really refreshing. It's really, really
the back really, and forth.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad it worked out for you.
Gulf Road, how'd you decide to cover that?
I think that's probably my father's perfect song, really. And for him, it's filler. He's never played it live. He wrote it so we'd have more songs on the record it came off of. And for me, that's his Hallelujah. That's his equivalent to Tom Waits' Hold On. It's a masterpiece to me. And I might have been foolish in attempting it, but I'd been playing it for years, and I had my arrangement pretty well set. And I was worried it would start to mean less if I kept singing it for another decade and didn't record it. So it was important to get it down then, when it's still, I felt very viscerally connected to it.
Curtis McMurtry, you know, that's the first time I've heard that segment. I really like the background noise of the concert and stuff there, Dan. I mean, you could hear the stuff going on at Fitzgerald's. It was nice being in the field.
Yeah, it does. It adds to the atmosphere a little bit.
We got to do that again.
Yeah, definitely. So,
okay, we're going to take a break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about the Disco Demolition book here on WGN.